The nature of kombucha is it's this aerobic fermentation. It's just kind of like a wild dynamic fermentation, right? So instead of like enclosing it like you might beer or wine and pitching one specific kind of yeast and keeping it very controlled, you just put a cloth over kombucha, right? And whatever yeasts and bacteria are active in the local environment and are more prevalent in one season than another are more active in that kombucha. So yeah, I firmly believe that kombucha made in Oregon is different than kombucha made in Washington, it's different than Florida, it's different than California.
Welcome to the Brands for a Better World podcast, the podcast that brings you the stories behind people and products building a more just, healthy, and regenerative future for us all. Tune in weekly, and together, we'll learn why these better products and brands were created, how they're helping fix broken systems, and what you can do to support them. My hope is that you'll discover some new brands to love and get some sparks of inspiration that will help you live your best life. Hi, I'm your host, Gage Mitchell, founder of Modern Species, a sustainable brand design agency helping better brands grow to scale their impact. This podcast is one way we do that. If you like the show, please help it grow by leaving ratings and reviews on your podcast app and by sharing your favorite episodes with your friends. Maybe this will be one of them. On this episode, I'm speaking with Matt Thomas, founder of Brew Doctor, about how he found his way into tea, what inspired him to launch a bottled kombucha brand, how the pandemic forced a shift in his business priorities, the new SipJoy product line he recently launched, and why he's committed to making the world better with his businesses. Then we wrap up with a rapid round question segment. Enjoy.
My name is Matt Thomas. I am the founder of Brew Doctor Kombucha out here in Portland, Oregon. See, you got the product. I appreciate the patronage. Let's see, not far from you, right? You're up in Seattle or Tacoma?
Yeah, I'm down in Olympia now, but for a long time I was in Seattle.
Gotcha. Well, fellow Northwesterner. Anyways, founded the company in 2008 after originally founding my tea company in 2003, just 1 year out of undergrad at the University of Oregon. Grew up here in Oregon, got my degree in business school with a second major in Spanish at the University of Oregon. The foundation of the company really grew out of a business plan that I wrote, 2002, my senior kind of class project, Business Administration 452, which was strategy and planning. He had to come up with an idea for a new business that served an underserved niche audience. And I felt that tea drinkers were underserved, that they deserved better, they deserved more. Because I, you know, myself was kind of passionate about tea, more so than coffee. I don't know, I just hadn't really fallen in love with coffee. And, you know, I'd find myself in coffee shops or meetings and seeing what all they had as tea options. And you know, it was very few tea bags or whatever, right? Or a box chai. And I knew enough about tea to know that there was a lot more to the world of tea. So I was like, well, here's an opportunity. I mean, there's a tea for every time of day, right? Tea to wake you up, tea to help you fall asleep, and everything in between, you know, from bubble tea to chai recipes from scratch. You name it, there's just so much opportunity with tea. So that was really the founding idea, was tea is an opportunity. It's this kind of blank culinary canvas and I was a business student and I wanted to start my own company. And so that was the idea. Get into tea, see what happens.
Yeah. So were you not into tea that like deeply before that? You just knew you liked tea a little bit more than coffee. And then you found like, hey, you know, I don't see a lot of tea shops. I'm going to get into it and learn more about it.
That's essentially it. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely over the course of the term when I wrote the business plan, seeking out everything and learning about tea, ordering a lot of tea online, which was new back then, 2002, not a lot of online shopping. But
so what was the tea shop like? You had like a physical location, people would come in and order a cup there of some loose leaf?
Yeah, exactly. We, you know, we started probably when I founded the first one with just like 50 different teas, you know, from black to green to oolong to chai, and then added bubble tea. And kind of as I learned about everything you could do with tea, just kept adding to the tea list. Because the idea was bring everything you could do with tea, everything that's done with tea around the world under one roof in kind of this cool coffee house setting. It was very much felt like a college campus coffee house, a little bit of library vibes. So I was very focused on the music and the lighting, providing a great experience and a place to enjoy. Probably something new, because a lot of people were being exposed to this vast catalog of tea, because we got up to probably 250 teas. Eventually, we just kept adding and adding, you know, because yeah. I mean, you'd make one chai recipe and then you'd make another one and you have all these spices and things. We're just blending. And before we knew it, we had a dozen chais that we're, you know, making from scratch to order. Like, everything was very slow. You know, our mascot is a sloth for a reason. It started with the tea house because it takes time. You don't want to rush the good stuff. Just settle in and enjoy. We'll have your cup or pot of tea with you, you know, within 10 minutes, which in a coffee culture, in a to-go cup culture, that was asking something different of people.
Right.
But, you know, then kombucha really grew. It just grew out of that desire at the tea house to give people everything that was happening with tea. You know, in 2008, people started bringing in GTs, essentially, you know, the one kombucha that was mostly available back then, and saying, hey, do you make this? This is tea. And I hadn't heard anything about it to that point. And one of my tea tenders, our staff, we called ourselves tea tenders, was like, oh, I make that at home. And yeah, I mean, if we want to make it here, I'll just bring in a SCOBY. It's funny to think that all of our kombucha has grown from that one little SCOBY that she brought in a jar.
From that one home SCOBY.
Yeah, you know, now our SCOBYs are 13 feet wide. And we didn't name it. We're not in the habit of naming our SCOBYs, but I suppose we should call her abuelita or little grandmother or something, right? Because she was the one that started it all.
Yeah, that's fun. I wonder how much I know, like, SCOBYs are all somewhat unique, right? Because each batch that you make, another layer or whatever of SCOBY. I haven't read any research to see, kind of like with different strains of yeast, how it affects the flavor profile. Do you know if each kombucha company couldn't possibly replicate each other's flavors exactly because of different SCOBYs?
The nature of kombucha is it's this aerobic fermentation. It's just kind of like a wild dynamic fermentation, right? So instead of like enclosing it like you might beer or wine and pitching one specific kind of yeast and keeping it very controlled, you just put a cloth over kombucha, right? And whatever yeast and bacteria are active in the local environment and are more prevalent in one season than another are more active in that kombucha. So yeah, I firmly believe that kombucha made in Oregon is different than kombucha made in Washington. It's different than Florida. It's different than California. Because, you know, we're not adding some one specific kind of yeast to make it all go. It's all just kind of what's there and what's been in your kombucha in the past and then what's in your local environment that kind of shapes that. So real interesting that way. And, you know, I mean, it makes a lot of sense that, like, that's why it's an ancient beverage, is because it was this wild fermentation that kind of just happened, right? I mean, people would add sugar and some, or, you know, fruit. That's how they first got alcohol, right? Fruit would spoil on the ground and, oh, it would taste funny. And it turns out it had alcohol in it, right? Because it was fermenting with the local yeast and bacteria to that environment.
Yeah, those monkeys look like they're having fun eating that fruit. Maybe I should try some too.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think the same thing is like how beer and other things were invented, right? It was just like some grain or whatever was left out during a season. And then all of a sudden it's like, why is that bubbling? Or there's something going on over there. Let me try it. And it's like, oh, that's actually not bad. Let me try to recreate this. And it kind of grew from there.
And you had famous beers from different parts of the world, and it's because these different yeasts were there that were more prevalent than elsewhere. And that's why that one was famous.
So I think you were saying that you ended up having like 9 tea shops. Was I hearing that correctly?
Yeah. So Townsend's Tea Company was the name of the tea company. You know, originally started out in December of 2003 and spent my 20s just trying to get people to come into a tea house in Portland, and didn't get a second one going until the end of 2007. So took a handful of years to get the one tea house standing on its own so I could get out from behind the counter. And then with $35,000 of credit card debt, go start another one. And then just kept going that way. Just get one going, start another one. Get it going, start another one. And I got up to 9 by the time COVID hit. And the thing about our tea houses is we didn't do a lot of to-go business, right? It wasn't to open back up in just a to-go cup capacity. We didn't get a lot of support. People wanted the experience of the tea house. You know, like I said, we were really focused on providing just a great atmosphere for the communities we were in, the neighborhoods we were in. And, you know, so the writing was on the wall that these weren't going to come back anytime quick. And, you know, with kombucha being the opportunity that it had become, you know, the team and I really just wanted to focus on the business at hand, which was keeping Brew Doctor going and growing.
Right. That makes sense.
So yeah, 9 tea houses in Oregon. And let's see, we had 7 in Oregon, 1 in Bozeman, Montana, and 1 in Park City, Utah.
Right. So during the pandemic, did you then shut all the tea houses down, it sounds like. And you said you put all your focus in Brew Doctor, but Brew Doctor was already kind of up and running at that point. What size or scale was Brew Doctor at that point?
No, yeah, Brew Doctor grew much faster than the tea houses. And that was, you know, another reason to focus is because, hey, if I want to grow this chain of tea houses, it's going to be one at a time and trying to figure that out. And, you know, the economics of a tea house are less than a coffee shop because you're not churning out as many drinks, you know, as fast. But anyway, yeah, so Brew Doctor had grown. Brew Doctor had its really big growth years in like 2015 to 2018. So it was already of a much bigger size than the tea house business, right? So the majority of our effort was already being put towards how do we grow Brew Doctor, and then the tea houses had become a lot of work, you know, and where my original passion was. So of course I didn't want to shut them down and I wanted to open more, but any time I spent working on the tea houses was time I didn't spend working on growing this fast growing opportunity in kombucha. So, you know, I did a similar thing with a distillery. We extract the alcohol out of our kombucha and the byproduct is organic alcohol. So we, of course, started a distillery when we started using that technology. We were the world's first and only tea distillery because you wouldn't do it otherwise. And we ran that for about 4 years. I think that was 2015 to 2018. We made a handful of tea liqueurs and a gin, a real botanical gin, and just a totally different business trying to run a spirits company than a non-alcoholic beverage company than a chain of tea house real retail locations.
That was a lot.
And that's the entrepreneur way though, right? We can't help ourselves. We're like, oh, that's a great idea. I want to do that. And you do it. And you try your ass off to make it work. It does for a little bit, but then you realize that you have to follow the opportunities that are paying the bills, that are creating jobs, that people are excited about. More than just your excitement.
Right, yeah.
So there's a little bit of humility along the way, for sure, with all the things that you try to do that don't have staying power.
Right, you got to kind of balance the excited entrepreneur who likes shiny new things and trying ideas out to see if they'll stick with the more CEO or whatever mindset of, oh, wait, but then I also have to make sure I'm being responsible and building sustainable, resilient businesses that have continued future growth and rationalize my SKUs and get rid of like 240 of my teas and narrow it down to the 10 that are doing best. And, you know, like all those kind of like hard CEO decisions versus the excited entrepreneur that just wants to do it all. So definitely understand that. And you explained the sloth a little bit, which I love that story. But what about the name Brew Doctor? Like you had Townsend Tea, like why isn't it Townsend Tea or kombucha? Like where did Brew Doctor come from?
Townsend's kombucha, yeah.
Yeah.
We thought about it and you know, we were just talking about it behind the counter at the tea house, you know, and I would always just, you know, a lot of the great ideas come from the people you work with, right? And I don't know, one of the tea tenders was like, oh, I think I got a great name for a kombucha company. I'm like, yeah, what is it? And he's like, Brew Doctor. And I was like, that is a good one. And, you know, I thought about it for a few days. And I'm like, man, I'm thinking about using that. Are you cool with it? And he goes, I'd be honored. Yeah, it's just kind of like yoga instructor part-time, tea house guy part-time. At the time, especially in 2008, kombucha was this new wellness drink, this health tonic. And so I wanted to go that kind of medicinal apothecary route, right? So Brew Doctor instead of Dr. Brew, because it's like a witch doctor. But you know what I mean? It's like, it's not like you're the doctor, actually, you're the Brew Doctor.
Yeah.
You know, we chose a stubby brown bottle and we launched with all just herbal kind of apothecary teas. We had a Nutritonic and our Clear Mind, which is still a top seller for us, was literally one of the first kombuchas we ever made. So we were kind of going that wellness angle. And I thought that was the right kind of marketing for the drink. And it certainly did fine. I wonder how it would have done, this Townsend's kombucha. You know, people had a hard time saying Townshends or Townsends. People call us Dr. Brew all the time, though, too. So you can't win.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. It's hard. But as long as they call it something or generally remember it well enough for a Google search term or something like that, then you're in good shape.
Yeah.
Okay. And you mentioned, obviously, at the time that you started it, the kombucha culture was still kind of early, a little bit more tied to the kind of healthy hippie weird drink kind of category rather than the full mainstream, like everyday space that it plays in today, I think. So what have you noticed has changed around that kind of kombucha culture in the last 20 years or so?
Yeah, I mean, well, it's still certainly regional. The more progressive food cities, and essentially the West Coast, typically to start with, right? where a lot of embrace of organic, you know, when organic labeling was new, you know, kind of the food is medicine culture, preventative focus on dietary nutrition as a way of life. You know, in 2008, it was just yoga studios and co-ops. And then, oh, there was this little space at Whole Foods. And then New Seasons, our local kind of natural grocer, added it. And so we saw it go from up and down the street and then co-ops to the natural channel grocery stores and then eventually cross into the conventional grocery. But when we started, it was definitely a, just kind of like a Whole Foods product. And so we got to participate in that really interesting, you know, period from, I would say, 2010 to 2014, 15, when all these grocery stores were putting kombucha on their shelves for the first time. And you get all this new population of consumers being exposed to it. And, you know, with mixed results, right? A lot of people were saying, like, what is that? It sounds weird. They try it once and the vinegar hit is too much. They're like, it tastes weird. Never again, right? They make up their mind. Or, you know, they get a bottle with a big gloopy SCOBY in it and that goes in their mouth. And they're like, what? There's a jellyfish in my mouth. And so there's a lot of experiences that people can have or did have that could put them off to it. As kombucha grew and kind of quality got tightened up and the window wasn't like this, but the window of consistency got much narrower, I think it's been able to exist Walmart, Target, Costco without issue. But, you know, I mean, there were wild inconsistencies in sugar and alcohol content and things that, you know, would be on the nutrition facts label from all the brands. And so as it was one of those things that as you scaled, you had to get better. That's why we put in the alcohol removal technology. We wanted to make kombucha our way, which it turns out was leading to getting on the edge of having too much alcohol in it, right? So early on, we committed to a technology that removes the alcohol to, you know, down to below that threshold that you have to be a non-alcoholic beverage. But it does it without heat. You know, it's a spinning cone column. It uses centrifugal force and the removal of pressure to essentially get ethanol to detach, to atomize from the rest of the liquid at a low temperature. And it's basically the only way, in my opinion, to make straight ahead normal kombucha and then take it to a wide audience, a mass audience, including under 21.
Yeah, because even if you left some of the alcohol fully in there, back to your note on consistency, it would probably be fairly different alcohol percentages from batch to batch to batch, depending on what fruit you're using or other things like that, right? So part of the alcohol extraction maybe helps keep it to a...
There are a lot of opportunities for inconsistency, yeah. So we just let our kombucha go to whatever alcohol content it's going to go to, and then we put it all through our technology that moves it all down to, you know, 0.2 or 0.3, with 0.5 being that threshold to stay under. Some other kombucha companies now use that technology as well, and then others have their own solutions that they've come up with as well. So it's been really interesting. And then, of course, you just have the alcoholic kombucha companies that don't have to worry about it.
Right, yeah. You know, you started with the tea shops selling regular, not fermented tea, and then you launched this kombucha. I know that you just launched SipJoy Probiotic Refreshers, like as maybe one of the first non-kombucha kind of products you launched under Brew Doctor. I'm also like, let's talk about that. But I also want to know, like, based on that innovation, have you thought about going back to your original tea roots and actually just selling like Brew Doctor iced tea or something like that too? But so maybe just start with, where did the idea of SipJoy come from? Like, why are you going down that path? And what other ideas are you brewing?
So SipJoy, you know, is essentially about one third kombucha. And then it's essentially sparkling water and fruit juice to achieve a beverage that has the benefits, some of the benefits of raw kombucha. It's still, you know, an unpasteurized raw beverage, but provides a drinking experience like sparkling water, right? So it's like an enhanced sparkling water. And, you know, we did it for a number of reasons: to compete and enter in a new space, you know, and give ourselves an opportunity to grow. But also, we really wanted to participate in a really low sugar beverage offering without using stevia or erythritol or, you name it, sorbitol, aspartame, all the things that just aren't natural food products, essentially, that are being put into liquids to trick our taste buds into thinking they're tasting something sweet. And, you know, there's plenty of study going on to say that those things actually aren't good for human consumption. And we've got a very like firm, like no artificial nonsense policy at Brew Doctor, right? It's why we're 100% organic ingredients. We're not going to use any additives, preservatives, food colors, and stuff like that. And it's for us, those fake sugars fall in that category. So we had this idea, we want to have a really low sugar offering for our consumers who are really concerned about sugar, though there's not much sugar in a Brew Doctor kombucha. We wanted to give them something with half or even less. So we wanted to, and at the same time, where was some white space, right? And you've seen the likes of Olipop and Poppy go after, you know, soda. And so we didn't want to just go after make up some root beers and colas and lemon limes. We really thought that sparkling water was kind of a space that was ripe for a little addition, a little innovation. So I think Rob was going to mail you some. Did you get a chance to try them or have you had them yet?
I didn't get the Sip Joy stuff, but I got the regular Brew Doctor, which, you know, I have had and it's delicious. And I am loving trying all the new flavors because I haven't tried all the ones that got shipped, especially some of the new ones like Pineapple Paradise. But I'm excited to try the Sip Joy. I've been drinking more sparkling water than I used to in the past, but similar to your values, like trying to stick to organic and not all the artificial stuff. So far, my favorite brand is Nixie, which is sparkling water with some like juice or tea flavoring kind of stuff in it. So I'm excited to try Sip Joy because it sounds like it's kind of up my alley for an addition to my beverage mix up.
I would say we hear a lot that it drinks kind of like a Spindrift. Spindrift is another kind of natural sparkling water where they just add fruit juice. I would say that's the one that we keep in our fridge at home. And I think one of your questions was if I'm looking back or if I could have invested in a beverage company or a company. I think Spindrift comes to mind. I think they've done a really cool job competing in that space in a way that I'm interested in as an organic food consumer and somebody, you know, father of three who's always reading labels, looking at what I'm giving my kids.
Right. Yeah, that's cool. So do you think that innovation will continue? Like you plan to kind of continue building on the kombucha or kind of beverage empire here and launch other types of beverages too?
Well, I think kombucha has a long way to go. I know that, you know, in the Pacific Northwest, you should be able to ask any stranger on the street, what is kombucha, and get a decent answer. But honestly, you go to a lot of cities in the middle and east and south of the country, and you're not going to see a lot of that. So there's a lot of opportunity still for education. That's why when I go to a grocery store and I see like GT's spending money on demos, I'm like, yes, good. The biggest brand in the category, spending money to educate people on what kombucha is, because that's what we need, right? Is this collaboration with all of us kombucha producers to continue to let people know that kombucha is worth their time and attention. You know, I mean, it's funny, people will say, well, kombucha is a weird word. I'm like, well, isn't yogurt a weird word for
yeah,
cultured milk or whatever it is, but
sriracha or something like that, right?
Yeah, you get used to it, right? That argument's always interesting. Like, yeah, you know what? Yogurt is a weird word. Anyway, so yeah, it'll just take time to enter the national lexicon in a full way. And so what that means is, I think, sustained, slow and steady growth for kombucha. The people that know and love kombucha, it's a pretty unique beverage. I mean, you are seeing kind of the prebiotic, probiotic sodas enter, you know, in the kombucha set, but I think the consumer's smart enough to see those as essentially supplements. You know, you're taking some sparkling water, you're putting this powder into it and this flavor and these bubbles, and I guess if it's got a pretty color and a fun name, you're going to try it. But, you know, the work to make real, authentic, raw kombucha is sloth-like, right? Slow. It's slow and there's a lot of patience. You know, we've stuck to our guns with the 100% organic commitment. And B Corp trying to go carbon neutral, you know, as quick as we can get there. Although Scope 3 is, boy, that's a challenge. And just the effort and what you get from an actual fermented 100% raw kombucha is a lot different than those kind of Frankenstein beverages that creep onto the shelf from time to time.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit about those kind of values too, because as people out there maybe are listening and they're like, you know what? I love kombucha. I need to find my brand, the brand I want to follow. Like one of the things I love about Brew Doctor is your commitment to organic, because I'm a longtime organic consumer and advocate. And then I'm also kind of fellow B Corp and 1% for the Planet member, which funny kind of story. I just noticed that We both joined 1% for the Planet in the same year, and we both got our first B Corp certification the same year. So on the same track there, which is kind of fun. But can you talk a little bit about the core values that drive those things for you? Like, why organic, why B Corp, 1% and 1% for the Planet, and some other things that you work on? What drives Brew Doctor? Why should people believe in your mission and support what you're doing?
Well, gosh, you know, I think it's just part of growing up in Oregon, maybe the Pacific Northwest, right? Where we grew up recycling, right? And doing to fund our soccer team, we'd do a can drive because we were the first state with a bottle bill, right? And in the 80s, we could actually go and collect a bunch of bottles and get 10 cents for them. And obviously, you know, we're surrounded, you know, we're in a Pacific wonderland. We're surrounded by natural beauty with giant trees and mountains and the ocean and rivers, and every direction you turn, you see something that's worth protecting. So maybe there's a bit more inspiration for us because we live in such an incredible part of the country and part of the world. But, you know, I don't know. I think you could, I guess, call it Pacific Northwest values, but I think it's just the modern way of doing business, right? Is, yeah, we want to grow a company. We want to create jobs. We want to do something cool that we're proud of. But we also, that pride goes into how we do what we do and the causes that we support and the good that comes from the work that is done. For so long, you'd hear about these giant corporations that, you know, is profit at all costs and shareholder value. You know, in the, you name it, the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and you're finally getting to this moment where, hey, there's this B Corp movement, and there's, you know, an actual assessment, you know, that people get graded on, that companies can get graded on and see how they can improve year to year. And it's inspiring, I think, to the people that work at the company, right? I think our level of employee satisfaction has only increased, you know, as we've given more and more attention to kind of our activities as a B Corp. A lot less turnover, you know, people feel a fulfillment when they're working, not just on how do we market this product and make some money, but how do we do it so that we can use business as a force for good, support something local, support something global, whatever it is that that person is interested in supporting. And as a B Corp, we give them opportunities to have a voice to say the kind of things we should support as a company or the goals we should have. And then with the B Corp, you know, with B Labs and the assessment, you're actually held accountable, right? You're going to lose your B Corp status if you don't keep it up and document it. And so all that is an investment. But what I'm saying is the thing you get out of it is less turnover, a more inspired workforce. It's huge for recruitment. You know, people, we get a lot of people applying for our jobs, and many of them say they want to work for a B Corp. They're drawn to working for us because they, you know, saw that we were a B Corp. And so I think you're getting this time now where capitalism or whatever is having this metamorphosis, and you're seeing bigger and bigger companies make those commitments, whether it be 1% for the Planet or some version of donating a portion of revenue, or B Corp, which is just all encompassing what you do as a company, from people to planet to product. So my hope is that B Corp stamp is the new USDA organic stamp, which now you shop that. You expect it to be on the food that you feed your kids, because you don't want to feed them a lot of unknowns in a world where, you know, everyone is touched by some form of cancer, you know, in their family and in their lives. So that's where the food is so critical. And anyway, so I think B Corp, my hope is that B Corp is kind of that next level of what's demanded by the consumer.
Yeah, I hope so too. I know right now it's earlier days of consumer recognition for that mark, but I know they're working on it, right, to get it out there. But, and 1% for the Planet has like slightly more consumer recognition, but, you know, the more brands jump on it, the more brands rock that logo more prominently. The more we all work together to do the consumer awareness or just awareness campaigns in general, like B Corp Month stuff, then the further along we'll get. But to your point, I have heard from a lot of fellow B Corps that during times where I hear the average business struggling to find good team members to apply for their jobs or whatever, that all the B Corps that I know have an abundance of people applying for jobs there. And it's, you know, just goes to show we're kind of, to your point, going through a kind of a metamorphosis, not just as a capitalism culture, but also like just the workforce. I think whether it's the new generations or going through the pandemic and having everyone on the planet have to question their priorities in life at the same time. But there's something going on to where a lot of those values, like B Corp, 1% for the Planet, et cetera, are not that they weren't good for business before, but that they're starting to bubble up as like proof of the pudding that like doing things the right way is best long term. And when people really hit a moment where they're asking what they want to do with their lives, go make rich people richer or do something important for the world, we're getting to the point where the average person is saying, you know what, I'm going to go do something important. Like that giant paycheck or whatever can wait. So I'm appreciating the evolution of the business industry. And that's actually why our business name is Modern Species, because we're here to try to facilitate that evolution and support the companies that are more involved. So love it. What would you say is the most surprising or difficult challenge you've faced in your decades of entrepreneurship so far?
I mean, certainly COVID was not in the plan for anybody. So all the, you know, the day-to-day battles that went on in 2020 and 2021 were unforeseen and, you know, everybody liked to say unprecedented. And so I would say, you know, and that came at a time, right, when we were, you know, we were kind of completing a national expansion. So we were really hoping to be a lot of boots on the ground, a lot of trying to get in front of customers at a time when you absolutely couldn't, right? So the balance of, I guess, just knowing that you can never really plan for the growth that you're going to get. You have to make the most of it when it comes. And obviously, you want to swing for the fences and plan to do great. But you really don't know what you're going to come up against. I sure didn't see that one coming. It absolutely, you know, hindered our growth, made us take a more conservative view of our aspirations. But, you know, we've achieved a national footing. We're in all 50 states and we're across Canada and trying to, you know, spread, you know, this special little kombucha that we make in Oregon, you know, under the banner of our B Corp values and our commitment to organic. And it's going well enough. We've come through COVID and yeah, I lost my tea houses. But I have aspirations to open the tea house of my dreams again someday, maybe after my kids grow up a little more.
Right. Well, that's spoken like a true ambitious entrepreneur. Like, you know, we've done well enough, even though you have what most people would call a pretty darn successful business. It's still like, you know, all the goals in your head of what you're wanting to achieve. And, you know, we always, at least in my experience, fall a little bit short of where we want to go, even if we're like doing really well on paper. And I'd say, obviously, you're doing quite well. And the fact that you're able to kind of pivot and shift into the business that's doing well during pandemic instead of just completely wiped out, scratching your head, wondering what's next. I mean, you've taken all the right steps to be resilient along the way, right? And just kind of going with the flow. And I'd also say that in terms of an evolution, you know, came out of college with this business plan to serve the tea market and your initial solution was tea houses. And then you figured along the way, okay, now there's this kombucha thing and maybe even the SipJoy one-third kombucha sparkling water stuff. And you're finding the right ways to pivot, which in my experience, that constant evolution is kind of the name of the game in business. It's never going to go the way you wrote in your business plan exactly, right? But that's a place to start. And then you kind of see where the market goes and you evolve and adapt over time. And that seems to be what you're doing. So I'd tip my hat to you and say, well done, sir.
Oh, I appreciate it. Yeah, I think being an entrepreneur is all about staying aware of opportunity and having the courage, I guess, to go after things and then also the courage to say, that one didn't work out and I need to cut it. It's a willingness to lose, but a drive to win.
I love that. I know you got to go, but if you have one more minute, we'll do the most rapid round ever. You already kind of answered a first question, which is kind of what brand you might have wished you invested in or founded, and you said Spindrift. But next question, what's your favorite tea?
Oh, man. I mean, tea I drink every day is a straight-ahead Yunnan. It's Chinese black tea, loose leaf. The better grade you can get, the better. The highest grade of Yunnan is called Golden Needles, and it's just beautiful, and it's right here on my tea wall. But yeah, drink that and a really good dragon pearl jasmine tea. And then for an evening tea, I drink a lot of mix of like a chamomile and a good organic peppermint.
Nice. Love it. Okay. And what's the best piece of advice you've received?
I had the pleasure of having a couple of phone calls with Greg Steltenpohl, who founded Odwalla before he founded Calafia Farms. And he passed away a couple of years ago. And he was just adamant, you know, as you grow, you're going to have these opportunities that you'll take in investors, other people, you know, board members. And he was like, don't forget, you're the entrepreneur. Do it your way. No one's going to work as hard as you are as the entrepreneur. No one's going to care as much as you do. No one's going to make sure the windows are clean. no one's gonna do the work that the entrepreneur does. So I think that was pretty inspirational and stuck with me as I did grow and brought in a bunch of other executive leaders and created a board of directors. And it's easy to be like, okay, I hired you. You've got a lot of experience. Take care of marketing or something, right? Again, no one's going to care as much and as hard as that founder.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, I'll do just one more in the interest of time. So what this podcast is called Brands for a Better World. So what does a better world mean to you?
Oh, man, that's such a big question. I'm supposed to wrap that up in 15 seconds. I guess it's everybody caring what the world is like for the next generations, right? And that's availability to food, availability to education, availability to clean air and water, and actually paying attention to the United Nations 17 Sustainable Development Goals and all the things that we know we should be doing, but as a human species program to just be squirreling away what we can keep. We're not exactly programmed to be so groupthink oriented, but maybe it's because I have kids or what have you. But yeah, a better world is one where the future generation is saying, oh yeah, they really set us up for success.
Yeah, I like that way of thinking about it. And it ties back into what you're doing, both with creating a healthier product for people, but then also being a B Corp, 1% for the planet, all that you're doing is kind of planting seeds that you may not harvest in your lifetime, but other people will. You know, it's I forget where that quote came from, but it was something to that effect of like true wisdom or, you know, true impact is planting a tree that you'll never get to sit in the shade of or something like that. It's like really cool idea of like passing it on to generations. So thanks for doing what you're doing to find the way through this crazy entrepreneurial maze to keep building cool things and to do it the right way. Because I think a lot of entrepreneurs, maybe when times get tough, will just start compromising. But that's why I love more impact-driven entrepreneurs, is because even when times are tough, it's kind of non-negotiable. We're just going to do it the right way or not at all. So I appreciate that you're continuing to stick to all your values and just putting out good stuff and seeing what sticks. So thanks for doing all that you do. And thanks for carving out some time to share your story with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me on, Gage.
Cheers. Thanks for listening. To learn more about Matt or Brew Doctor, go to brewdoctorkombucha.com. That's brewdrkombucha.com. If you like this show, remember to help us grow by liking, reviewing, and sharing. If you're new here, don't forget we have over 100 episodes in the archive. Some might be called Evolve CPG, but it's the same show, so dig in for more goodness. If you consider yourself an impact-driven professional, join me over at impactdriven.community, where we're supporting each other's growth as impact leaders.